Boeing machinists remain on strike, American unbundles its fares, and an interview with Joel Meyer, author of an open letter to the airline industry leadership, this week on episode 18 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. Hello, everybody, once again. Welcome back to the Airplane Geeks. Max, I got to be honest, I forgot what episode this is. Is this episode 18?
18 it is.
18 it is. This is Courtney Miller. With me, as always, my co-host, Max Flight. Max, thanks for joining.
Oh, hello, everybody. Hello, Courtney. I understand you're just back from a little family gathering.
I am. I was at my brother's wedding this weekend. He is on his way to Hawaii right now, where he will board. He will disembark from his A330 and board his caravan, his Cessna caravan.
Oh, excellent.
To continue his trip to the islands. So we were kind of talking about that this week. Yes, very eventful week, and we record on Sunday night, so you'll have to excuse me as I'm overcoming a cold and a lot of alcohol, which apparently did not remedy it as I had hoped it would. But I do want to talk about our guest for this week. It's Joel Meyer, and Joel Meyer is a marketing professional with extensive experience in a variety of industries, and you may recognize Joel from his famous blog post, which is from thinkforamoment.typepad.com, an open letter to the airline industry leadership. Joel, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Mike, great pleasure to you too. It's a real honor to be here.
We only have a handful of news stories, but they are of all great interest this week.
They sure are. Let's get started.
The first article that we want to talk about is from FT.com. This is the Financial Times. Blink and JetBird aim to slash private jet costs. Undaunted by the difficulties that have recently beset similar ventures in the U.S., two startup groups, Blink of the U.K. and Ireland's JetBird, are setting out to make private jet use more affordable, offering prices of up to 50% below those of other operators. They have already placed orders and options for nearly 150 aircraft for delivery by the end of 2013 from U.S. and Brazilian plane makers. Those are Cessna and Embraer. The Mustang is the VLJ from Cessna, and Embraer builds the Phenom 100, which I believe is their business jet version of their Embraer 135. Max, especially after our discussion last week with Shane Price, this seems to be Europe's attempt at pulling a U.S. version of Dayjet. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. It's a slightly different business model from that used by Dayjet, or attempted by Dayjet, in that Dayjet tried to sell individual seats, combining passengers with common destinations. And apparently, these two, Blink and JetBird, are not doing that. These two are instead looking to supply the entire aircraft for a destination, not on a per-seat basis.
And that kind of brings in the hybrid of the hybrid, if you would think of it that way, in the industry. Whereas, you know, Dayjet was supposed to be so revolutionary in that they were going to do an on-demand charter service and sell by the seat. That differentiates them from, say, a typical charter operator. Blink and JetBird seem to be wanting to play off the marketing benefits and the so-called innovation benefits of Dayjet, but there's nothing spectacular about what they're doing. I mean, they are going after an economy of scale, but they're still charging for the aircraft, all ACMI, all fixed costs, all variable costs, to one customer. That is what charter does. I don't see what the business plan offers anything over what all the other charter operators are already doing, unless I'm missing something. You know, they're still going to have the problems of deadheading empty aircraft if passengers don't want a round trip or there's nobody, say, at that airport, which is going to happen 99.9% of the time.
Well, apparently they think they've got a business plan that's viable because they are moving forward. I mean, you know, before getting started, given the state of the economy worldwide, if that model did not look to them like it was going to pan out, this would be certainly a kind of the opportune time to back off a little bit. At least you'd have the excuse of the poor economy. But apparently they're not doing that, and apparently they're going forward.
And unfortunately, this news story did come out after we had our discussion with Shane, but I would love to get his input on this because he mentioned several things about the private jet industry in Europe, and most specifically, he pointed out how few local airports there are, whereas in the U.S., almost every town larger than 1,000 people has an airport. In Europe, that's not so much the case. Another piece in the puzzle that is, what are the VLJs going to bring to the world? And I don't think anything has been proven yet.
No, not yet. I mean, in the article they mentioned that JetBird is looking to provide service in what they call a contained network. That ranges between 75 European airports, and they're looking to really kind of base that around five main operating bases. So maybe that's kind of a hub sort of approach to it. I'm not sure.
Now, Joel, let me ask you: have you ever have you ever been in the market for a charter aircraft? And I guess at what price point do you start considering, as a frequent business traveler, looking at that option?
I've never been in the market, quite frankly, for this level of service or this type of service. What I have found is my needs for travel, both domestic and abroad, have been such that the commercial airways have been more than accommodated for me. Granted, less than perfect, but in terms of time and in terms of price, I've been able to get done what I've needed to get done. What I will say, however, is that colleagues and friends who have been in the market and utilized services like this, to your point, what I have found is that more often than not, it is the severity of a specific situation that brings about such a need, not so much kind of a lifestyle or a general mode of travel. Right? There's an immediate need that comes up that requires someone's to be in a different city, a different country, a different continent, and the commercial airlines aren't just able to accommodate it. So, but, let me put it this way. I aspire someday to be able to deal with such issues like this. I think it's a good problem to have.
But it's interesting. It sounds like the default method of travel for the business traveler remains at this point with the airlines, with the status quo, unless the air taxi industry or variants of it can provide some service that's incremental or fill some gap that really business travelers aren't quite ready to look towards that solution to their travel.
I think price is really the bottom line, right? I think at the end of the day, the business traveler that engages in kind of a more custom route does so for one of two primary reasons, I would hypothesize. One is the emergency need, and or a need that the commercial airlines can't accommodate, and two, quite frankly, is ego, right? The ego associated with being able to do something of this level. Those are, I would hypothesize, the two main drivers. I hope to never be at the ego level, and I hope never to have an emergency of such gravity that would require me to do it. I think for net-net, with the amount of routes that are available, specifically in Europe, as you pointed out, right? Look at the success of Ryanair, EasyJet going into not primary, not even secondary markets at times, but tertiary markets, and the success that they've had. So I think there's a whole lot going on there.
Okay, I do want to move into our next article, make sure we get through them all and have time to talk with Joel. This comes from the Seattle Times, of course. The Boeing machinists have been on strike for, I think, the past 2 weeks. Is that right, Max?
Oh, longer than that now. I think it's been almost a month.
Again from the Seattle Times, CEO McNerney says strike hurts Boeing reputation. In a memorandum to all Boeing employees, James McNerney, he's the CEO of Boeing, noted that leaders of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers have recommended strikes four times and have shut down Boeing's commercial aircraft assembly plants three times with walkouts in the past 13 years. While we've disappointed customers for other reasons in recent years, too, we believe this track record of repeated union work stoppages is earning us a reputation as an unreliable supplier to our customers who ultimately provide job security by buying our airplanes. Mark Blondin, he's the chief union negotiator, did put out in a statement. He responded saying, this is not a strike to harm Boeing or its customers. The article does point out that the union is on strike because members have made it clear that protection of our union, the union is on strike because members have made it clear that protection of union jobs and the scope of work is critical to getting a ratified agreement. So this kind of spells out just everything that's going on. This obviously is a salvo, kind of to a public salvo by Boeing at their union representatives. And I can't say, Max, that I disagree with what he's saying.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, the strike represents a a discontinuance of service to the customers, to the airlines, and you know, that's a problem to a certain extent. I mean, I think the industry is pretty used to, you know, job actions of this sort, and you know, everyone knows that these things can happen and they come and they go. But I think McNerney's point is that, you know, if this happens repeatedly, then you know, Boeing tends to suffer in the eyes of its customers relative to the competition.
Going back to our Labor Day episode where we were talking with Rob Mark about the then upcoming strike, the major sticking point, of course, with this is the issue of scope and the Boeing request to outsource more work, whereas of course the union is trying to prevent that. So it seems like this is in a pretty solid stalemate, although this article did come out October 9th, and I believe on the 10th there was another article that said that Boeing and the union had gone back to the table over the weekend, so we'll see what that brings.
Yeah, I mean, they need to do that, but this, you know, this is all about jobs, or primarily, and you know, it's about outsourcing, and you know, there really is a different, you know, different viewpoint. The, you know, the union has said that they ought to have the opportunity to bid against other suppliers when Boeing is looking at outsourcing, and you know, from one standpoint, that, you know, that makes sense, and really, I think, you know, Boeing or any company that's looking at outsourcing is doing that. I mean, that's part of the reason for outsourcing is trying to be competitive and utilize low cost suppliers, but that's not the only thing in you know, in this industry. It's, as we've talked about before, it's an international industry, and you know, everyone is looking to share in the business and award business to suppliers that allow them to share in the business. So if you want to sell in China, for example, then, you know, you really need to have some components produced in China in order to win their business.
Okay, this next story is from carrentals.co.uk. American Airlines moves to fare unbundling. American Airlines is set to speed up the trend towards breaking up the cost of air travel into a fare plus numerous other fees. Beginning in 2009, American, which paved the way for airlines to charge customers for checking a single bag, will initiate an a la carte pricing structure similar to that in use at Air Canada. The officials indicate that there will likely be some basic fare plans with additional services available to passengers at a price. Max, the big issue here, I think, is that, you know, you've got the legacy, quote-unquote, full-service carriers, which are acting more like the budget, you know, low-fare carriers, comparing that to Southwest, which is a low-fare carrier by definition, and they are providing the all-inclusive service. So they're kind of flip-flopping, and, you know, if they're going to offer a first-class product, if they're going to offer, you know, a full, fair, you know, highly optimized revenue product, this makes it very difficult for them to find their brand. I'm not so certain that this is necessarily the right direction for the legacy carriers, because people don't expect that. That's not why they fly the legacy carriers. They fly because of the schedule, of the frequent flyer programs, of the and then of the price. I understand the carriers are trying hard to differentiate themselves, and the commoditization of the industry is a big problem in their eyes.
Sure, sure.
And this seems like a method to combat that. However, I'm not certain that it's necessarily going to help, because even though we're having problems with technology this evening, technology will keep up, and they will always allow people knowledge, and that includes the ability to compare pricing at different airlines dependent upon what services they would like to offer.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there's some analogies to this. You know, first off, I will admit I am easily confused, and you know, there are some industries that are very good at confusing me when it comes to pricing and services. You know, take for example the cell phone industry. You know, try to compare, different plans. Well, not even across different providers, but even different plans from the same company are confusing. I like simplicity, and you know, life is complicated enough. And if the airlines are gonna, you know, have to cause me to you know, undertake a big analysis prior to selecting my my airline, that's just not what I'm looking for. It's too confusing.
Now, and you know, ironically, you say that, Max. You say that it's too confusing, and they're pitching this as a simpler way to travel.
Yeah,
I agree with you. I think this greatly complicates things. It is aimed at confusing the passenger, because I tell you what's going to happen, and they're pitching it as, if we have a $200 fare and Southwest has a $200 fare, well, we're going to subtract what we're only going to make you pay what you want to pay for. So your fare only may be $160. So
right.
You don't have to pay for all those services that Southwest forces you to pay. But that is not what's going to happen. You're going to have $200 and $200, and oh, by the way, you've got to buy all these other things. Because when you search on Orbitz, you search on Travelocity or Kayak or whatever the case may be, you're going to see $200. And then we're going to force you to pay for these extras if you want them. And by the way, you find out later that you've got three bags and you have to pay for them.
Yeah, I mean, I have a conspiracy theory on this one, which is the following. You know, I've said all along that the biggest disruption to the models, the business models of the airlines, has been the internet, because what we have is now are consumers that have perfect information or near perfect information, and a lot of industries are struggling with with that. You can't differentiate yourself as easily when the consumers have perfect information and your services and products become commodities. So by introducing this, you know, fees and this kind of unbundled pricing, you know, the conspiracy theory is that maybe it's an attempt to reintroduce that kind of confusion, take away some of that perfect information, and let the airlines get back to doing the marketing in the ways that they're used to and feel comfortable with.
You know, I agree with that, Max. I mean, it really has to be a goal. It has been identified in airline marketing departments, and it has to be on the chalkboard to take out commoditization. You know, we kind of touched on that before, but to do that, you either have to strongly differentiate yourself or just confuse the heck out of them.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I think, you know, we did, and this is to the point, several points you make on your blog, Joel. You know, people are sick of being nickel and dimed. You fly quite often, at least it sounds like, and you know, you are sick of it. You know, we did have several news articles where these extra fees are paying off for the airlines, but I think that there's some at least validity to the argument that people just didn't really realize what was going on. And Joel, you are experienced, so you've seen this enough to know, and you're sick of it. So I think that people are going to kind of eventually, you know, maybe a year from now, start to have a backlash to this type of quote unquote unbundling, and they're going to say, you know what, it's just too confusing. I want my $200 ticket on Southwest. I'm already there. It sounds like, Joel, you're already there. We'll see if the rest of the country arrives.
You know, if I can make one more comment on this one, because I think it's a fascinating on a lot of levels. You mentioned earlier about the core essence, the brand of a company.
Right.
And what I find interesting is go back a couple of years when you saw the mainline carriers trying to be innovative with the advent of TED and with the advent of Jazz and a host of others that was their attempt to compete with the low-cost providers, right? We're different. We're irreverent. We have funny colors, too.
I agree entirely with what you said. You know, this does get back into, they just don't know what they want to do. I mean, the airlines still have not answered to the low-cost carriers. You know, did they respond by trying to create low-cost carriers within their brand? Well, no, that didn't work. You know, I think that's been proven, at least is widely considered to be the wrong thing to do with the demise of Song and TED and, you know, Airways Shuttle and all those. And is this just the next thing? I mean, are they just kind of sitting around the office with nothing to do and said, hey, you know, why don't we try this? It's tough
during the reservation
on the brand.
Where I had the ability to make my choice of seat, I only then learned, and I went back and realized that in the bottom of the prior page, in small font, it did say so I need to be very honest here. It did say I was going to do this, but when I got to the page where I picked my seat, I had to pay to book ahead of time. I had to pay for an aisle, right? And so under the umbrella of, hey, I'm giving you choice. You want to save money? Well, you've got a seat, but you can save money. But that violated the canon of air travel at the time and was the first one that I was aware of that was doing this. And it baffled the hell out of me, and it really ticked me off. So I think you're right. It's a very fine line when you're dealing with price. Right? Price and simplicity don't necessarily go hand in hand. AirTran, I will tell you, the first time I used the reservation system, November of last year, did not do a good job of that. And so I think the execution, right, we talked about the brand, but the experience and the execution of how they bring it to life is going to be another aspect to this that they really, really need to capture perfectly, right? Otherwise, it's going to be another abysmal failure.
And I do want to move on to our next story because this is very interesting and it really follows the lines of the discussion that we're having. This from the Australian Business. Study reveals what we love and hate about flying. Almost 75% of passengers would like to change their seats once they have boarded their aircraft. Another 3% say an attractive flight attendant is important. The survey of more than 10,000 travelers across 13 markets also found that 56% of passengers rated getting there quickly and easily as the best thing about air travel. Now, this is from Cinovate. Apparently, they put this survey out to several different passengers, and the results are expected in some instances and rather surprising in others. Max and I were talking about this before the podcast. Just a couple to throw out there. It was the seat the passengers are trapped in for 15 hours that were most concern to passengers. That should not be surprising. But some a little more surprising statistics that came out of this study, the Cinovate survey found that most air travelers were not irritated by having to sit next to children.
I thought that was a surprise.
The British were the most intolerant at 55%. Who were irritated by sitting next to children, and the Germans were the least likely to get frustrated, with only 15% agreeing.
I guess the Germans like children for some reason. I'm not sure why, but, you know, this was a pretty comprehensive survey, it sounds like. I mean, 10,000 people participated in this, and it across a number of different countries, and the differences in the response by sort of country of origin or culture were really fascinating, and this one with sort of the tolerance for children is just one of many examples that are in this survey
of parenthood. But because I'll tell you, I don't know if you gentlemen have kids, but as someone that does, I have immediately, as soon as my daughter was born, I immediately became tolerant, patient, and understanding of everybody else's kids in the world.
Sure, exactly. You join the club, and then the world looks a little bit differently. But there were some other interesting things, with respect to wanting to change or move seats. Some cultures seem to be more prone to want to sit next to the window, and others, you know, like the aisle. One that I thought was particularly interesting was, I think it was the Thai culture that, from childhood, they're taught, not to step over people. And it's just sort of ingrained in their culture. It's part of it, and that's fine. But that also means that they're more likely to, sit huddled painfully in their window seat when they really need to be, in the lav. But they're just afraid to step over someone.
And I think it just goes to show you, what is it that the carriers can do to better understand those types of differences to enable them to be true to their respective cultural needs, but still deal with the biological and human elements all of us have to deal with. To me, this is a phenomenal opportunity, right? It's an opportunity for a learning lesson for the types of carriers that we're speaking of to really take notice of, to be more culturally sensitive. Not that they're insensitive, but that they could better create an experience by being more sensitive.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, one size fits all is not insensitive, at least overtly, but on a certain level, in terms of effect, it really is. And there are opportunities if you can, as you say, Joel, to recognize those differences and cater to them in ways that are appropriate for the cultures and that you're serving.
That's exactly right.
Okay, moving into our main topic, which we are talking with Joel Meyer, and he is a marketing professional, again, extensive experience in a variety of industries. And Joel, we want to talk to you about your Think for a Moment blog. Specifically, you seem to have drawn quite a bit of attention about your open letter to the airline industry leadership. Can you kind of tell us, is there anything in particular that kind of prompted you to put this on paper or on computer monitor,
well,
as it may be?
Again, guys, a real honor to join you tonight and to be able to talk about this issue. What prompted me, we all go through life and we travel when we have to, and sometimes things are imperfect. And I've noticed through a variety of different industries, employers, clients, etc., that what really allows a company to differentiate itself, is by how it deals with those moments of imperfection. And I had an unfortunate death in the family a month or two ago, and it was the carrier's interaction with me as I sought to find a reasonable, right, a challenging word, but a reasonable fare for 2 days' notice to travel what would normally be a route that cost $148, I think that was the range. And so it was through that interaction and that back and forth, that dealing with the carriers, ultimately finding a fare that was, quote, reasonable, only to find out that on the return leg back, that specific flight, which would have been hundreds upon hundreds of dollars, only had 19 people on the plane. And I thought to myself, this is really, really absurd. And yes, there's always two sides to the equation. Yes, I appreciate the pricing model and the nuances of supply and demand. I get all that. But what struck me in that exact moment at 6:38 a.m. leaving Hartsfield Airport, Atlanta, was there's something missing from this equation, and that one of the basic tenets that I believe and I promote is that you need to balance two major things in business. One is, what are the business needs and business goals? And the other is, what are the consumer's needs and the consumer goals? And you never allow one to dominate or outweigh the other all the time. It's a balance. And the company that strikes that balance is the one that I believe will create loyal customers, vocal customers.
Sorry, Joel, do you think that, sorry to interrupt, do you think that larger companies have more difficulty striking that balance than smaller companies, or is there some other thing that differentiates who's able to successfully strike that balance versus who's not?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, and I don't know that I would look at it relative to size, but if I were to look at the landscape of firms, large or small, I would say that in general, smaller ones are more successful at doing that. But I don't think it's because of the size. I think what it really stems from is leadership understanding of this balance and their ability to inject it into the company DNA early on. So if you would try to transition a very large company now, it would take years, absolutely years. Two phenomenal examples out in the industry of companies that have done that include Best Buy, right, in Minneapolis, and Tesco, the UK grocery store chain, who have taken years to do it. Now, they've invested, they've prioritized, they've done it. So it can be done. But I think it's more likely seen in the entrepreneurial firms that are generally more startup or smaller, where leaders subscribe to this and require it of all positions within a firm. And it grows from there. Southwest is a perfect example of that. I had the privilege of seeing the CEO speak. If there's any doubt whatsoever that he understood and understands the balance between their goals and the customer's goals, then I don't think people have looked or read enough to really understand that he gets it better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. So it's not an impossible task for the other airlines, the big old legacy airlines, but sounds like you're suggesting that they have to A, first start down that path, and B, it's going to potentially take a long time to get down that path.
The first step, right? The first step is to acknowledge your troubles, right? And I think that as we talked about earlier with the example of Ted and Song and Jazz. They thought there was an easy out. They thought, okay, to compete with this upstart company, right, who has since had other entrants in the market space, follow a similar model to Southwest, a few more frills in the case of JetBlue. But I think they felt that, okay, let's just take the easy way out to compete. And because it wasn't in the culture, because they didn't fully understand that, I need to enable that division to be completely separate. Here's your money. Go do it. However you see fit, go do it. That allows leadership to do things differently and put it into the DNA. But harnessing them with legacy systems and legacy processes meant it was a recipe for failure from the very, very beginning, as we mentioned earlier. So, it does take time. It takes a lot of time. The bigger the company, the lengthier the time. But I think the primary, right, if I were to prioritize these guys, the primary issue is leadership has to understand that there's an issue, and secondarily, they need to be absolutely vocally committed and resource the project appropriately. Right? Culture change is the hardest thing to do, but if you don't acknowledge you have to do it, it will never happen. And I think I'll play the odds on what's going to happen to those companies long term that don't get it.
Is the question, I guess, is the size of the company not necessarily the issue, or is that just kind of a symptom of people, or a reason for people taking accountability and wanting to see the company do well, as opposed to, like you were talking about, the customer experience you had with an airline where you're dealing with one frontline employee and they may have just felt like they had just been screwed over by their airline, and they don't care.
Change is really, really hard, right? Change is, at a personal level, at a professional level, change is the most difficult thing in the world to do. And I think we can't discount that too easily. Many of these firms, many of these carriers and leadership have been involved with them for a really long time. They don't know, right? And so when they see an exception, right? Southwest is an exception to many of us, I would argue. And if it's an exception, that just means I need to try harder or reapply ourselves or stick to my guns but reduce costs, right? And I think it's the rare leader who really has the ability to say, we need to change the way we do things. And yes, it will be painful, and yes, it will be costly. But if the goal is long-term growth and success, then I think we're in a kind of a new world order where the consumer is so empowered to make fully informed choices now that if the consumer paradigm has fundamentally changed in the past 20 years, yet the carrier paradigm has barely changed for some of them, then it's not hard to identify the disconnect. But again, it boils down to that leader or that leadership that says, you know what, we've got to go down this path. We have to if we want to be here in 10 years or 5 years or in some instances even less.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, well said, Joel. We are going to throw a curveball at you. I don't know if you've listened to the show, but with all the guests, we make sure that we torture them with a little bit of word associations.
I was not aware, but I look forward to the challenge.
Basically, it's just as you thought. We're going to give you a word, and you just tell us the first word that comes to mind. As awkward as it may be, or as off the wall, we accept any words, and you can kind of quantify or qualify your answer as you'd like. Max, do you have?
Let me ask a question first, guys. Is this a family show?
Figure
I can
yes.
Download bleeps.
Okay.
Max, do you have yours?
Okay, first I have this, Joel. In-flight entertainment.
In-flight entertainment, I think movies.
Do you are you satisfied with what you get from in-flight entertainment on your business trips?
You know, I am. To be honest with you, I really am. I think Qantas has an unbelievable in-flight system. Unbelievable. Cathay Pacific, I think, rivals it. Outside of that, the rest are fine, right? They're adequate. But in terms of really blow me away that I want to rant and rave about, it would be those two. The only downside that I have seen thus far, and I see it in some business, some first class, is put a damn power outlet in the seats,
yeah.
Right? So that you can empower me to take care of my own entertainment, be it my iPod, be it my PC. But that is a potentially a cost reduction, right, for the carrier by merely putting a plug in every seat.
And Jill, I think there's some movement in that area. I don't have anything to quote you, but I know with Wi-Fi there is a lot of talk about power ports. On more of a mass scale, so hopefully you're going to see that come about here in the near future.
That would be a good thing that I think would be widely appreciated by absolutely everybody, right? And one minor data point, last year was the first year that notebook computers to consumers outsold desktop computers.
Ooh.
So, well, people have portability, people have the power, and they sit here in this car and the train that I'm on, I see no less than 11 notebooks powered up and in use right now. Guess what? Plugged into a socket.
Yep.
And by the way, I think a train might be a little bit more outdated than a plane, so if they can figure it out, I would venture to guess an airline.
I agree. Okay, Joel, my first word, culture.
Culture. I think leadership. I think the word that comes to me is leadership. And what I mean by that isn't necessarily the corner office or the C-suite. What I mean by that is every person being a leader for their own area, for their own tasks, for their own people, but or even just to themselves, right, to lead themselves down the right path. I think a culture that is full of leaders is one that will survive and thrive.
Okay, great. My next word is actually three words. Airport passenger services.
Airport passenger services. You know, I think immediately is of the car, the little golf cart thing with the horn, yelling, move, move, move. I think of. Airport passenger services. What I find so fascinating about that term, now that I have more time to think about it, is what comes to mind beyond the cars that play a really integral part in service to those passengers that need a little extra assistance, right? So I don't mean to mock them. They are absolutely a critical part for those people's experience. What I think of is going through the international terminal at Heathrow, which, by the way, looks nothing like a terminal. It looks like a shopping mall that should rival the largest and the most luxurious shopping malls in the world. It's just store after store after duty free, and that's just what a wild and different experience it is now than when I started flying 40 years ago. Fundamentally different.
Great. Okay. My next word, Joel. Two words. Frequent flyer.
Frequent flyer. I think miles. I'm not being too inventive for you guys tonight, but I think miles. It immediately makes me think of a loyalty program, which probably speaks to, if I overanalyze it a little bit, probably speaks to the success that carriers have had in promoting those types of programs. Right? Frequent flyer is someone who, yes, flies a lot, but a flyer, someone who has a whole bunch of miles to be redeemed when the airline says it's okay, and for the two seats out of the 300 that are available. And of course, I'm mocking a little bit here, but that's what comes to mind: the miles that come and the benefits that are derived from the person that gets to fly oh so very often.
Now, you seem, Joel, to diversify, let's say, your travel experiences among several different airlines. Are you particular to any frequent flyer programs, or are you truly searching around for the best deal or what suits you best on each trip?
I used to, I'll be honest, when I lived in the Bay Area, I had the benefit of being able to fly within literally 40 minutes of my house out of Oakland to San Jose or San Francisco. And I did a lot of travel through Asia Pacific at the time, and San Francisco being a hub for United, I was a very loyal United flyer, very, very loyal. They took extraordinarily good care of me. I felt, I'll give you proof points of what I feel are proof points if you want, but I felt they did a very, very good job. And when the Chase credit card came out, right, from the United program, I was able to get extra mileage above and beyond the travel that I was doing. And so I felt that the combination of the service they provided, the flexibility, and the frequency which they could get me to where I wanted to go, be it domestic or international, and above and beyond, I can now marry to my real miles, my points miles from my credit card. I was a very loyal United convert for many, many years. As we sit here today, I've evolved a bit, and to be clear, travel is, as you said, travel is a commodity. And for me, what I think about now, whether it's my own travel or corporate travel, I think about getting me there in the time that's required from a carrier that does not have a track record of being excessively late. And for any of you who have flown up and down the Eastern Seaboard, Philly to New York, Boston, there are a few that are known to be late all the time. And that's an issue. That has an impact on me. So I think about costs. I think about on-time rates, ratios. And things like entertainment or food, those are so secondary. Those so don't matter whatsoever at all anymore, because we travel with our luggage, right, in on the airlines, in the cabin. I have my computer. I have my iPod, which is my entertainment. I pre-buy the food out in the shopping mall before I get on. So those are no longer needs for me as a traveler.
Yeah, I've got one more. And true to form, I can't stick to one word. It's one thing, but it's not one word. Passenger Bill of Rights.
A a wonderful, wonderful concept, a brilliant concept. It's unfortunate that it took the situation that JetBlue created to come up with that, right? It was absolutely tragic it took that. But let's applaud the effort and let's applaud the speed at which that was issued and the conviction that's been behind that, I think, to really deliver upon that. The challenge with anything like that, right? I'll give you another analogy. The Google in their mission statement, right? Do no evil. Well, when you throw something out that broad, it's kind of hard to hit it all the time. You're going to fail in some people's eyes. And so when you have a passenger bill of rights, it sets a bar really high that you're never going to deliver 100%. But I think that's okay. I really think that's okay because I think what it represents is that leadership that we've spoken of. And that commitment to the lifeblood of the company. Because while the lifeblood is often considered kind of the frontline reps or the agents, right, the people that see face-to-face to the consumers, and from an internal perspective, that is the lifeblood. But let's broaden it out a little bit. The lifeblood of a company are its customers. Without it, there's no business. And so to be on the forefront and to demonstrate that type of commitment, I think is to be heralded and to be embraced and to be abided by. I don't know if I can go so far as say at all costs, right? But absolutely as much as possible.
Certainly. Okay, so the last word, Joel, is pretty traditional. Airplane geeks.
Airplane geeks. What comes to mind, I think, are handsome, charming, very stallion-esque male.
Max, this may be our best guest yet. I mean, really, clearly the smartest one we've had on the show.
Or the most delusional.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't been 5 hours on a train, and there's a wonderful cocktail service, so I'll let you guys do the math.
Joel, great. Again, even through the difficulties, we appreciate you joining us, and your insight is very valuable, especially since we are so interested in kind of hearing from the end user, which is the passenger, without muddying the water of liking airplanes so much. You know, we get involved in the business so much that it kind of makes it difficult to see the forest from the trees, so we are impressed by your perspective.
My great honor, guys. I really appreciate the time, the opportunity, the conversation. I look forward to further chats with you as the months and years go by. A credit to you and to your listeners for being so committed to a critical part of our lives, and a real honor. So thank you so very much for having me.
Thank you, Joel. Thanks again to Joel, and now we will move into Max's pick of the week.
Yeah, I've got something from a website called Dark Roasted Blend, and this particular page on this website is Monstrous Aviation, World's Biggest Airplanes. What this page has is a series of photographs and drawings and illustrations of really truly monstrous large aircraft of various sorts. Along with some history about it and some more detailed descriptions of some of the particular aircraft that are here. And it's really a wide variety. It includes some, maybe you call them fantasy artwork aircraft. Also aircraft that were planned or hoped for but never built, as well as actual aircraft. And it really is a fascinating collection. Some of these things are really bizarre. One in particular is this Russian Ka-7 that's from the 1930s. The giant aircraft, eight engines. This thing looks like it's about three stories high. And this is something from the 30s. So. There are some really interesting concepts there, some really interesting designs. If you want to find some other interesting aviation items on the site, just go to the darkroastedblend.com homepage and poke around there, and you'll find a link for aircraft. And besides the world's largest airplanes, they've got some sections on aircraft, you know, incidents, big oops, photographs, things of aircraft that have found themselves driven over walls or crashed into ground support trucks, and a variety of interesting and usually embarrassing kinds of situations. So take a look at that. That's darkroastedblend.com.
Thanks, Max. Several other items to discuss. One, Max and I have started talking about our next new media meetup, and we think we're going to be holding it in November. We still haven't talked about a topic, but get ready for that. So I think about the middle of November, Max. Is that about right?
Sounds good. Yep.
So we're going to shoot for that.
Okay.
Also, please make sure to check out Flightline Internet Radio. You can hear excerpts of the Airplane Geeks there. Of course, if you've gotten this far in the podcast, you've already heard everything you could hear there, but we still like you to support what they're doing over there. A lot of really good music, a lot of great excerpts from other podcasts. You'll hear Rob Mark on there. He does a weekly column that I think is very interesting as well. So please make sure you go to flightlineinternetradio.com and support them. We also are online with our website. Go to airplanegeeks.com, and you can sign up for our newsletter there. That's something new we're doing. We've mentioned this a couple times already. We want to keep on mentioning it because slowly but surely we're getting new subscribers. Essentially, we will be sending out the show notes in this weekly newsletter, as well as news that we did not have time to cover here on the podcast. So make sure that you keep up to date with everything that's going on in the airline industry and the aviation industry, that is, by signing up for the Airplane Geeks Week in Aviation newsletter. You can do that on the right side of the homepage. Please also send us any email with questions, comments you may have, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, or if you think that you would rather scold us with your voice, you can do that on voicemail, 812-757-4252. Leave a voicemail, or you can even email us an MP3. We'll make sure that we get you on the podcast. Other than that, Max, I'm kind of hustling through this, but is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think we've done it, and another episode in the can.
Another one in the can. A large thank you to Joel Meyer again for joining us this evening. I do apologize for some of the sound issues. He was on a train with a cell phone, and we did lose connection a couple times. But of the stuff that you were unable to hear, I can tell you that Joel is a fascinating guest, and we hope to have him on again sometime to kind of continue the discussion. So thanks to him. Thank you, Max, and thank you to all the listeners. We will see you next week on episode 19 of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We'll see you guys.
Bye, everybody.